I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. After almost 2 years, the results of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into links and coordination between the Russian government and the Trump campaign was made public yesterday with redactions. Attorney General William Barr held a press conference before the release of the report and put a positive spin on the report, essentially saying that the president was exonerated with no findings of collusion and obstruction of justice. He did criticize how the investigation has hurt the Trump administration.
Attorney General Barr appears to have shown an unsettling willingness to undermine his own department in order to protect President Trump.
That actually was the wrong clip. That was Jerry Nadler. I should say that House Judiciary Committee Jerry Nadler, having none of it, accusing Barr, frankly, of mischaracterizing Mueller's findings. The Mueller report did not find the president committed a crime, but found plenty of wrongdoing, showing the campaign had multiple contacts with Russians, lied about it, and that President Trump wanted his staff to interfere with the Mueller investigation, even fire Mueller, something they did not do. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Craig Green, professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. He worked in the Department of Justice from 2001 to 2004. Craig Green, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by telephone is Sarah Lynch. She's criminal justice reporter covering the Department of Justice for Reuters. And Sarah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Do we have Sarah? Let's get her squared away. Well, let me turn to you, Craig, if I could. So President Trump was not charged. He was not exonerated. There was plenty of wrongdoing. I mean, it seems we're all in a kind of legal purgatory.
I think that's about right. I think there are a couple things to say about the report sort of by way of introduction. I think it's a monumental document. And what's it a monument to? It's a monument to truth-telling. It's a monument to thoroughness and detail. There's a lot of evidence here some people will be familiar with, but it's laid out in such very lawyerly sorts of ways. It's the best stuff that lawyers do is write reports like this. And I think in a lot of ways, Americans should be grateful for it. With respect to obstruction, particularly the particular concerns of evaluating the culpability of a president were what Mueller was focused on. So he gives tons of evidence about obstructive conduct by the president, the nexus to trying to stop the Mueller campaign, including firing Comey, including threatening to fire Mueller, including trying to get Sessions, Attorney General Sessions, to unrecuse. There are very clearly obstructive acts that the president tried to take and attempted to take in connection with the Mueller investigation with the intent of trying to obstruct that investigation. And yet, the Mueller report did not conclude that the president committed any crimes. He left that conclusion to us, the political system.
Well, we will pick up on all of that. Sarah Lynch, do we have you on Radio Times?
Can you hear me?
Absolutely, yes. No, thanks
okay,
so much
great.
For joining us. You're down there in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
What is the mood in our nation's capital today as a result of this report?
Well, you know, I think Democrats are feeling pretty outraged. You know, when we first heard basically the summary of the report in a four-page letter that Bill Barr sent to the Hill on March 24th, he glossed over a lot of the details, I think, about how bad the evidence on obstruction was. Now, the letter did say there was evidence on both sides, but that does not capture, I don't think, what it really says when you sit down and read the details. And because there was no executive privilege invoked by the president, we're able to get this really fascinating window into conversations inside the White House with between Trump and his aides, where he's essentially ordering them to, have people not cooperate or have people say things publicly that make him exonerate him or put him in a good light, anything that could potentially hinder the investigation. I think, though, you know, from where Democrats sit now, they're in a tough situation. They don't want to push the envelope too far and call for impeachment. Nancy Pelosi is trying to kind of hold the reins on that a little bit and say we need to get more information. We need to do more investigation. But some of the more liberal newcomers to the House of Representatives are taking a different tone. So we're going to see how that all plays out in the next couple weeks.
Well, let me take apart some of this report, and it is 500 pages. I flipped every page. I read a lot of it, but not all of it. And it's a fascinating read, I should say, to our listeners. Now, we have heard from the president. We even heard from Attorney General Barr about the fact that the report found no collusion. And that's the word. I think we're all familiar with it now. But Mueller wasn't looking at collusion. In fact, he said that's really wasn't productive. It's not a legal matter. He was really looking at criminal conspiracy.
He was. And he was looking at one other thing, too. He was looking at the Russian interference with the election, first of all. This report wasn't all about Trump. The investigation wasn't supposed to be all about Trump. It wasn't all about the link to the Trump campaign. It started out with Jim Comey trying to investigate Russian interference. And this report found a lot of it.
Right.
Found interference in the form of Facebook and Twitter accounts and fake rallies and very real money and organization. It found military-grade hacking of the DNC, all for the purpose of furthering the Trump campaign and damaging Hillary Clinton. This evidence is all laid out in great detail. The intelligence community has been there for a long time. But this report, and let me just say one extra thing.
Sure.
You know, it is a long report, and everybody talks how long it is. But actually, for your listeners out there who don't have all day to read this report, there's like 20 pages that everyone could read. The first 10 pages of Volume 1, the first 10 pages of Volume 2, they're brilliant. They're actually very, very clear and cogent. And for people who don't have a week to digest this sort of stuff, I think you get a really good sense of the kind of evidence of interference and the contacts with the Trump, not conspiracy, but the contacts between the Russian campaign and Trump are very clear from the report.
Sarah, let me go to you.
I just wanted to piggyback on that. You know, a lot of us, I think, yesterday in the press and just in general were focused more on Volume 2 of the report, which is the obstruction, just because there's information in there we hadn't known before. But I think we don't want to lose sight of the fact that as a whole, when you read Volume 1, I mean, this is historically unprecedented as far as we know. The efforts that a foreign state actor went to try and influence a campaign of a major U.S. presidential candidate. And when you look at it holistically, it is just, it's jarring, it's disturbing. It talks about efforts to infiltrate voting systems in Illinois and get access to voting, the polling data and information about voters. And it also talks, interestingly, even though there was no evidence of conspiracy, there's a lot of cases of contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russian officials, and also evidence that they were duped as well by some of these efforts. The Russians adopted these online personas that were retweeting negative information about Hillary Clinton or very divisive messages, and many, many people within the Trump orbit were retweeting those and posting those on social media. It talks about Michael Flynn's son being one of those people, mm-hmm. Roger Stone, who's now under indictment and facing trial in November. And so I think, people lose sight of just how important and impactful the findings were about the lengths the Russians went to try to influence our election.
In fact, let me quote something from the report. In sum, the investigation established multiple links between the Trump campaign officials and individuals tied to the Russian government. Those links included Russian offers of assistance to the campaign. In some instances, the campaign was receptive to the offer. While in other instances, the campaign officials shied away. Ultimately, the investigation did not establish that the campaign coordinated or conspired with the Russian government in its election interference activities. Very specific words. What's your takeaway?
Yeah, and the other thing to bear in mind is that they couldn't establish that conspiracy or coordination. But this investigation also showed evidence of lies and cover-ups. It showed evidence of missing phone records. There was even sort of in the spirit of drama, there was one of the characters in the story committed suicide.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of reasons to think that the gaps and the absence of evidence isn't itself even exonerating necessarily. But I think the important message for the American people is Mueller took a hard look at all of the evidence, lays out the story in a very clear and readable way that I think that's impossible to have any serious disagreement with.
And there's a question that's been hanging out there, which is why would someone lie about something that didn't happen?
Absolutely that. And I think those questions come up time and again as one reads through what we're referring to as Volume 1, the material about the Russian interference and the contacts of the Trump campaign with that Russian interference.
Sarah, anything you want to add before we move on to obstruction of justice?
I think we'll be learning more. A lot of the information that's redacted in Volume 1 relates to what they say are ongoing matters. And it's clear, even though there's a lot of redactions, that a lot of that relates to Roger Stone. Roger Stone has been charged with lying to Congress and witness tampering in connection with his House intelligence testimony, and the question about whether he knew or was in contact with WikiLeaks prior to the release of thousands of damaging emails from the DNC. A lot of that stuff's redacted, and so what I think will be interesting to look at going forward as we approach the November trial is if there is any new information that sheds light on contacts between the campaign and Russian officials in connection with that. And also, of course, separately, Assange has since been charged in the United States in a separate matter. But it does raise a lot of questions as we proceed on that case about whether some of this material may factor into that case as well.
You think some of that material is hiding under those redactions, Sarah?
It's very possible. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever see it, at least in the near future. But hopefully, maybe one day we'll get a little bit more insight.
Well, it will be interesting to see what is under there. Craig, let me go back to you. And as our lawyer here, describe or define what obstruction of justice means.
Sure. So obstruction of justice, as the report defines it, involves some sort of obstructive act, some act that actually was intended to impede. And then the second element is some ongoing investigation or grand jury testimony. And the third, with some level of intent. It has to be some sort of so-called corrupt intent. And so I think here that could be, for example, the president's effort to protect himself from investigation. Or I think it also could cover his desire to shelter some of his affiliates, like Michael Flynn or Paul Manafort. Any effort, act, nexus, and intent, I think, is obstruction of justice.
I'm looking at the clock here, but let me just toss something else out here. But he is the president of the United States. And I was doing a little thought experiment for myself, substituting a CEO or a member of Congress, or frankly myself, in the Mueller report, that if I had done all those things that the president is accused to have done, would I be facing some kind of time?
Craig, go ahead, and then Sarah
will get you in as well.
Very quickly, I think, or the National Security Advisor, any high level of government. The only person who gets the kind of institutional leeway that Mueller assigns and that, frankly, DOJ policy assigns is the president himself, a unique constitutional status at the top of the executive branch. I think anyone else would have been charged.
Yeah, Sarah, go ahead.
I just wanted to chime in. We interviewed a lot of attorneys yesterday, and most of them seem to think that anybody else, including somebody actually gave me that example of a CEO, would have been charged in this instance. But there is a longstanding policy at the Department of Justice concerning the fact that a sitting president cannot be indicted. And if you look at the report, that policy deeply factored into Mueller's determinations and legal analysis as to how to proceed and the prosecutorial decision-making that went on in this case. And then, you know, another attorney that I had interviewed yesterday sort of put the different episodes into two buckets. And he said some of the matters discussed here are sort of garden variety obstruction issues that would come up in any case. Any effort to try to suborn perjury, any effort to try to intimidate witnesses or ask people to lie is certainly chargeable. And then there's other acts like firing Comey, which might be protected under the Constitution.
And we'll pick up on that issue right after this short break. That's Sarah Lynch, Craig Green. We're talking about the Mueller report. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about the Mueller report today on Radio Times, probably like the rest of America. Our guests are Sarah Lynch. She's criminal justice reporter covering the Department of Justice for Reuters, joining us by telephone. And Craig Green is here with us in our Philadelphia studio. He's a professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, and he worked in the Department of Justice from 2001 to 2004. Let me give out that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And already on my screen, I see lots of questions coming in from our listeners. Well, let's dig a little bit even deeper into this whole question of obstruction of justice. And I think, you know, Exhibit A is the president trying to get lawyer, attorney McGahn, to fire Robert Mueller. As it turned out, McGahn refused to do that. In fact, he said he would resign first before he did that, a sort of a Saturday Night Massacre-ish kind of scenario here. Mm-hmm. But as you look at that, Craig, and then to you, Sarah, I mean, how significant is that? And how, in many ways, is that not obstruction of justice?
Yeah, so I think, and I think I have to say this just at the risk of, I think rather than listening to Bill Barr, or even rather than listening to me or anyone else talk about the report, I think people who wonder about obstruction just have to read the first 10 pages of Volume 2. And I think when you read that material, you'll come away with something confirmed by the next 200 pages, which is there's episode after episode, many involving trying to fire Mueller, actually firing Comey, trying to intimidate Sessions into unrecusing himself, many, and tweeting about giving pardons, all these efforts to obstruct the Mueller investigation with the intent of doing so for corrupt reasons, not public-minded reasons. And the only reason, which is what we were before the break, the only reason that Mueller does not indict him or even declare that he would be guilty of this sort of a crime is because he's the president. And just at that very last step is the last step that we, the readers, have to fill in. And I think that's what any reader would do, reading episode after episode of this sort of obstructive conduct.
So is the president above the law?
In this sense, ironically, because there's another section of the report that says the president is not above the law, but at least he's above the special counsel, I think is the way to say it. The special counsel explicitly refuses to consider whether the acts the president did amounted to obstruction of justice, not because they don't, but because they do. If he were to exonerate them, he would have exonerated them. But he says both in the quoted at the summary and at the very last words of the report, he is not exonerated.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Sarah, just picking up on that, is McGahn, Lewandowski, Priebus, and others essentially prevented the president from even a more serious infraction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the pattern here is, I think it sort of is pretty much confirming what we've seen in many media reports since the start of this administration and a couple very well-known best-selling books. People are repeatedly asked to do things that make them uncomfortable, that may be potentially illegal or immoral or unethical, and they refuse. Or they pass the buck, they ask somebody else to do it, and that person refuses. And so time and again, people in this report that worked in the White House appear to be saving the president from himself. And I think the star witness in a lot of this is Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, who repeatedly tried to steer Trump away from making very bad decisions, was repeatedly asked to do things he didn't feel comfortable doing. He kept asking Trump not to meddle with Sessions once he was recused. You know, he was asked multiple times about firing Mueller. He refused to do that. He threatened to resign. And so I think he actually has emerged as a really interesting star witness in all of this. And a lot of these people made the right decision as far as not carrying out these orders, because it would have been obviously a lot worse for the president. I do want to also
And probably
note,
for them as well.
Yeah.
And probably for them as well. I do want to also note, though, and really interesting thing here in this report, while it does not determine one way or the other whether there was obstruction of justice, it clearly opens the door for Congress to make that determination. There's a very really fascinating legal analysis that was conducted here, which talks about the role Congress can play in this. And I think that's the opening that Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, is going to be using. And whether or not that leads to an impeachment proceeding is obviously yet to be seen. It's too early to know that. But Mueller's interpretation here is that Congress is well within its rights to examine these and determine if these, in fact, these acts collectively constitute obstruction. And the report also does urge readers, when looking at this, not to just look at each incident in isolation, but to look at it as a whole. And when you put it together as a whole, it's a very powerful picture, I think, that's presented.
Craig, you want to say something? Yeah,
two really quick, vivid examples, I think, of what Sarah was talking about. Don McGahn for radio viewers says he wasn't going to do crazy stuff for Donald Trump. And I think another episode is Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon says, you know, you can fire the FBI director, but you can't fire the FBI. And my message is, when a president goes too far for Steve Bannon, he's gone too far. And then I think the other message with respect to Congress, I have to say that I'm actually very disappointed in the report in this regard. I think the idea of trying to pass the buck to Congress or to some future prosecutors, this was a huge mistake. And I think that it'll be very hard for Democrats to make any significant movement forward, given the Mueller refusal to find himself. To find himself at obstruction guilt. I think that's very difficult.
Well, let me pick up on that, because you said earlier that essentially, according to, I guess, more precedent and policy, is that the president cannot be indicted. But what could Mueller have done if not that?
So Mueller's job under the regulations, and maybe a little technical, but his job was to file a report that explained his decision. That's the verb, to explain. And all he needed to do, as far as I'm concerned, is explain why he did not prosecute the president. And the answer to that's very simple. Even though there was all this evidence of guilt, even though there were all these things that he had done wrong, he literally was not going to indict the president. Now, if you're a lawyer and you're looking for it, you will find that in the report, in the first 10 pages of Volume 2. But you have to be looking for it. He's a smart man who knows how to use language very well. He could have said much better than I just did. What he actually did was protect the president. Mm-hmm. And I think he just didn't say that for his own reasons, and we could talk about those too. But I think kicking it to Congress is a mistake, and I think they won't follow through with any sort of impeachment. I think it's the American people who have to read and decide in 2020.
Was he protecting the presidency or the president?
I think it's the presidency for sure, but I think in protecting the presidency, he ignored his responsibility under the regulation to explain why he did not indict the president. And he did not indict this president, even though he committed guilty acts because of his status in the institution.
Sarah, let me pick up on that. And I believe that William Barr is going to testify before Congress on May 1st. Are there efforts to bring Mueller before a congressional committee?
Yeah. Yes, there are efforts to do so, and William Barr was asked about this when we attended the press conference yesterday, and he said he would welcome it and not have any concerns with it. And I believe they are trying to set a date. I don't think they've done so yet, but they want to try to have him testify sometime before, I believe, May 23rd. So, but I think their plan, though, is they want to hear from Bill Barr first. That is something Democrats have talked about. They want to hear his thoughts, especially, I think, there's one area in particular that came up yesterday that we don't have a lot of insight into, which is disagreements that Bill Barr and the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, had with Mueller on his obstruction of justice legal theories. And so they're going to try to get as much information as they can from him. He's supposed to testify 2 days, actually, May 1st. Before the Senate Judiciary Committee and May 2nd before the House Judiciary Committee. And after they get that information, then they're going to try to use that to help them, I think, prepare for having Mueller come and testify.
And that's Sarah Lynch, criminal justice reporter for Reuters. And with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Craig Green. He's a professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to get to our callers, but something, Craig, that you and I were talking about before going on the air, comparing what happened yesterday to what Comey said a couple of years ago. So this was the summer of 2016, talking about Hillary Clinton and her emails.
Yes. So Comey, some of your listeners will remember, Comey commented twice, actually, about the investigation into Hillary Clinton. And at the time, again, some people will remember, there was a policy against having that kind of commentary. There's a sense in which, according to orthodox policy, Comey spoke when he should have been quiet. I think it was one of the criticisms. Right. And my view of the Mueller...
Since there were no charges against
her. When there were no charges, he shouldn't have said that she was reckless or any of the other things he said. And all sorts of things he should have said. But then by comparison, Mueller, I believe, had a regulatory responsibility. Comey did not. Mueller had a regulatory responsibility to explain his decisions. And I think on the obstruction charge, he did not explain it. For his own, both of them, I think, I don't know them personally, but both of them, I think, acted from their vision of what's best for the country and what's best for healing and closure. And they just wanted, but I think that in each context, I think they would have been much better off, and the country would have, if they had just done their job the way other people had done that job. And I think that for Mueller, there, I think if he comes to testify before Congress, the only thing that I would like to have him do is what he was supposed to do in the report, which is explain in clear language why he didn't prosecute the president. And I think it would come out much like we've discussed today.
Let me read a bunch of comments here. One from Anne saying, if a sitting president can't be indicted, could he be indicted after he leaves office? Sarah, can you answer that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that might also that's part of, I think, what is factored into the Justice Department's legal opinion on this issue, that that in fact he could be indicted after he leaves office. There are, of course, statute of limitation issues there that you'd have to work around. But that is the idea. And I think the other idea that people have is when you can't indict a sitting president because he's still in office, the recourse is impeachment. That's what the only other option is if you're not able to indict. And so that's why the idea would be that Congress looks over the evidence and removes him. And then once he's removed from office, then they could do a criminal case against him. And I think that's sort of the line of thinking.
Well, and just to add to this, looking at the report, it looks like Mueller has sent something like a dozen or more referrals. So there are other pieces of this story that are being investigated, maybe the Southern District of New York, and who knows? You're nodding your head, Craig.
Yes, I think there are a lot of other criminal consequences that are ongoing, a lot of redactions related to that Sarah referred to earlier. A lot of other people might be prosecuted for various actions. But I think, and Sarah's also right, the report refers to obliquely the possibility of future prosecutors or of impeachment. I just think that's so unrealistic. I think the idea of a future president or future Department of Justice prosecuting an ex-president, it would really be remarkable. And that's why I say I think the real remedy is not referenced in the report, but it's for all of us to talk about. It's an election. And that is to say that a lot of people now know things to a greater degree and with greater detail than they knew before. It's credible. It's verifiable. And I think America as a country will get to decide in 2020 whether this is, aside from criminal responsibility, aside from impeachable offenses, whether this is an acceptable presidency or not. And I think I would be regrettable if I think we didn't keep that third and most important option on the table.
Sarah, sounds like you want to say something.
I just wanted to also say that is you know, a good point, but I also still have a lot of questions, and I think there's still a lot of open questions about these other referrals. As most people may have seen, it's been reported in the press multiple times, the Southern District of New York in particular has taken on a great deal of investigative activity in connection with the Trump Organization. There's investigations into the Trump Foundation. There's investigations that are still related to the payoff to two women to silence information about affairs that the president had with them prior to becoming president. So, you know, there are still a lot of irons in the fire that we just don't know where that's going to lead. And I think a lot of people have thought for some time now, as more and more information has become public leading up to this report, that the most damaging investigations may not ultimately come from Mueller's office, but may actually come out of the Southern District of New York. Of course, that remains to be seen, but they are doing the kind of investigating that Trump has previously referred to as a red line, looking at finances, looking at his activities of his children. So, there's a lot going on that we don't know the answers to yet, but that may end up being the downfall.
And obviously, Mueller was looking at a very specific part of the campaign and whether Russians interfered. And the consensus from Mueller and also from intelligence communities that they did in favor of Trump, whether people accept that or not, it seems like that has been defined and is accepted truth about the matter. Let me read another comment, this one from Jane. How can the public defend ourselves against the current attorney general's actions when he acts more like an attorney representing the president than the Department of Justice? And I wonder, Craig, how you see that. I mean, clearly he was saying things that the president has said about no collusion. He had that 14-page letter last summer where he seemed to say that this whole question of obstruction of justice cannot be applied to President Trump. How do you see the attorney general?
Yeah, so I think there are two things to say. I think the attorney general's conduct is, in any other context, pretty embarrassing and maybe even disgraceful. But I have to say that in this context, in 2019, I think to look at this episode and focus on Barr is the wrong person to focus on and the wrong misconduct to focus on, and I think a distraction from the much more important issues. I mean, for goodness sake, the president has engaged in disgraceful activities. That's what the report shows. How can anyone muster the strength and energy to get upset about how Bill Barr presented the report, which speaks for itself, about a president who's going to be in office until 2020? You know, none of these legal matters may very well pan out, but they're really legal issues like the report for us to think about in the election. Nothing is going to happen, prediction, nothing is going to happen legally before 2020. The next reckoning is ours, not anybody else's.
Well, I wonder, Sarah, about Barr's reputation in Washington. I know when his name came up for attorney general, many people were very laudatory about his past behavior and seemed to think that he was a fine choice for the president.
Well, you know, Democrats have always had concerns about Barr. You know, before he became a nominee for attorney general, he sent a 19-page unsolicited memo, which to this day we don't quite understand why, laying out his ideas on obstruction of justice and why Mueller was working on a flawed theory. And as it's come, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how it's all come to basically play out the way he had kind of called it in that memo. So I think there was a lot of skepticism about by Democrats specifically about that and whether he would be, a fair and impartial arbiter of justice, and he would be the people's lawyer versus the president's lawyer. But by the same token, I just want to point out on the opposite side of things that we've come a long way as far as reputation's concerned, as far as respect within the building. You know, Barr is very different from Jeff Sessions. And of course, there was a lot of consternation over Matt Whitaker when he was appointed as acting attorney general. Many people in the building, I don't think, thought that was even a valid and legal appointment. And Barr has been attorney general before. He has great respect. He's also just a very personable person. A lot of people, I think, overall feel better with him there. And it's a lot more like a return to normalcy, I would say, compared to the prior two attorneys general that we've had. So on that side, his reputation, I think, is still probably strong.
I hear you.
Compared to the other two that we've had before this.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the Mueller report, what's in the report, what it means, where things go. That's Sarah Lynch, and again, criminal justice reporter covering the Department of Justice for Reuters. Craig Green is a professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law here in Philadelphia. He also worked in the Department of Justice from 2001 to 2004. Lots more to talk about after this very short break. More comments, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can tweet us at whyyradiotimes. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. And we got one more clip waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
And that was candidate Trump in July 2016. I should add that a couple of hours later, WikiLeaks did its document dump of a bunch of emails from Hillary Clinton. There are so many various clips, but I'm looking at you, Craig. Why is that? And someone even put a Facebook comment. Why is that not either collusion or conspiracy or even obstruction of justice?
Sure. So I think that material about Russia is about this coordination conspiracy. And the problem in the evidence is that it doesn't establish a coordination between Trump and the Russians or Trump campaign and the Russians. Now, the closest it came to is actually the Trump Tower meeting, where, of course, Donald Trump Jr. and others tried to meet with Russian agents to get information about Hillary Clinton. That really would have been, I think, conspiracy, or of course it would have been, maybe it was, an election contribution from a foreign government. But the problem with that meeting is there's not evidence, and it seems like the evidence points the other way, that anything actually useful came from that. So the goods or the bads on Hillary Clinton that they went there to get, intending to violate federal election campaign and perhaps giving more solid evidence of coordination and conspiracy, but that particular meeting, despite all worst intentions, did not actually pan out to be that thing.
Well, it's so interesting because there are intentions, there are motives there, but what I guess what the law looks for is actual evidence of a more formal relationship, more formal.
Correct. There needs to be some agreement, and there are a lot of close calls, so that's just the closest, but there are a lot of close calls, but when it comes down to that last piece of a real connection or coordination, almost everywhere it fails. In the Trump Tower there was, but there were no goods to be exchanged. Yeah. And so sort of time and again, reading through Volume 1, which is about the coordination and conspiracy, there's so much damning and damaging evidence, but it doesn't actually legally get quite far enough.
Susan, you want to add? Excuse me, Sarah, you want to add to that?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, if you don't have intent, if you're kind of an unwitting participant, if the Russians in many cases are coming to people in the campaign, reaching out, or people in general are reaching out, if you don't realize if you're sort of being co-opted by them, that's not evidence of a crime. I mean, there's a lot of careless behavior. Donald Jr. is portrayed in this report in a quite unflattering light. There's also another kind of nutty example where somebody from WikiLeaks sent him some information with a password, and he actually puts the password into his computer and uses it. Wow. And finds out it works. And then he sends an email to the campaign staff saying, hey, guys, I got this email from this direct message from WikiLeaks. The password works. What should we do with this? I mean, there's a lot of just kind of behavior that appears to be maybe not the smartest behavior, but it's not evidence of a crime.
Well, it's so interesting because this whole notion of intent, I mean, if I intend, Craig, to punch you in the face, but I don't, I still intended to break the law, to hurt you.
Yeah.
But the laws, unless I really, make contact, it didn't happen.
So I'd say, again, it may be important just for listeners to separate the Russia from the obstruction. In the Russia area, you had some areas where the Trump campaign intended but didn't succeed, and other areas where they received information and help, but they didn't know they were Russians. They were careless and they didn't ask questions. They just got the rally money or whatever else. And then on the obstruction, I think there really is much more substantial evidence of corrupt intent, the legal term corrupt intent. And the only reason that the president is found not to be guilty of obstruction of justice, the only reason is because he's the president and because of the constitutional significance of holding the chief executive liable that way.
There was another reason, too.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say, another reason that was articulated by Barr, in addition, there is that policy, correct, but Barr has also said another factor in his determination for why there was not obstruction, and I know this is controversial, but his idea was that because there was no underlying crime, there was no conspiracy with the Russians, he couldn't find that there was obstruction. And I don't know if you want to talk about that more, but I think that is kind of a lightning rod as far in the legal community, and I think a lot of people are debating whether that is a flawed interpretation.
Well, and Craig is about to jump out of his chair.
To strike as lightning. So, of course, the Mueller report says it's not true that that's a requirement, that you have to have some other crime. Second, of course, I've said before, no one should listen to Barr about anything. He has a bad client, and his name is Donald Trump, and he says a lot of things that aren't reliable. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, obstructing the Mueller investigation with respect to Michael Flynn is actually obstructing with respect to a criminal act. Even if Trump himself didn't commit conspiracy or whatever else, there were other criminal acts in play, including Michael Flynn, including Paul Manafort. And so when Trump obstructs the investigation into those crimes, there are real crimes that he's obstructing the investigation of. So regardless of anything in Volume 1, I think those arguments are really quite terrible.
But I heard or saw Barr talk about non-corrupt intent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's
and I
how
think,
he...
And I think it's a mistake. Barr's characterization is wrong. So the corrupt intent is to try to stop the investigation for not public policy reasons, but to shelter your friends and yourself. And that's the intent Donald Trump had from start to finish.
Let me get Fred, who's been very patient, waiting on the line, calling us from Doylestown. Fred, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you, Marty. I love your show.
Thank you.
So I think, real quickly, I think there are some much bigger implications as to what to do with this Mueller report. much bigger implications than this presidency and even the coming election. So I tend to disagree with your guess here. So it's pretty clear that, you know, Donald Trump tried to cover something up, and he was very nervous about the release of this report, and that he committed either a conspiracy or perhaps intent to commit conspiracy of obstruction of justice. And I think that just like we did with Bill Clinton when he lied to the public, it's up to Congress to set the bar, pun intended, and not low, hopefully, to set the bar as to what is acceptable from a president. Because this Congress, their job is to say it is not acceptable behavior from a president. And if they don't make that statement, even if the impeachment doesn't go through, if they don't make that statement, we are setting a new precedent for future presidencies in the United States.
Well, Fred, I appreciate the call. And Sarah, you want to respond to that? We touched on this earlier about what Congress may or may not do. What do you think?
Well, you know, if you are not happy with the way that Congress handles this, I mean, we have two different political parties controlling each branch. We have the Democrats in the House, and they're even acting tentatively about whether to act on this through impeachment, which would be the ultimate option. Right. And we have the Republicans controlling the Senate, and they're obviously not going to do anything of the sort. If you are unhappy with it, the only recourse that I can think of would be go to the polls and change that. Put people in that will take steps, you know, to prevent that and vote against Donald Trump and change the leadership. I mean, I think there's little people can do. I mean, they could of course write to their congressmen, they could send letters, they could protest, but at the end of the day, I think the voting is the most powerful tool.
But let me toss out Bill Clinton's name. I mean, he was impeached by the House. He was not removed by the Senate. But nonetheless, the country, for better or for worse, went through that process. I mean, I don't know if it was good for us or not. But nonetheless, well, it is a tool that the House of Representatives has.
Well, that's funny enough that we bring that up. I mean, Ken Starr was appointed under a different statutory framework. This is a little bit in the weeds, perhaps, but he was appointed under a different statutory framework than Special Counsel Mueller, and he delivered his full report without redactions to Congress. It was extremely explicit in detail. It created a lot of political pain there. Negative headlines. It was difficult for the country, and as a result of the way that was handled, Congress did not reauthorize that statute, and the Justice Department wrote its own internal regulations to make the report essentially confidential, which is why we had to wait a whole month to even see this, and there was a chance we wouldn't see it at all. So I think another thing we need to look at is how do we feel as a country about the way this regulation works. Is this too constrictive?
Sure, go ahead.
Can I just
jump
in? Because Fred may want to disagree with me, but I want to agree with him. I think there is something in the failure to react legally to, which is what I predict, to obstruction of justice by the president, which is something that hasn't been tolerated before and I think risks being tolerated now by the legal system, by the attorney general, by a special counsel system, by a Congress that is too divided. Why? Because America is too divided. In the end, one can blame the politicians or the Senate or the House or whatever, but it's representing, in a way, I think the American public is going to, reality, prediction, sacrifice some element of legality of the constitutional order and tolerate illegal actions by the president and have the only remedy be a political solution in 2020. So I think there are real, that's what Fred, I think, was raising, this bigger issue of what kind of lawlessness is tolerable in the United States. And I think this is a really, from my perspective, from the Attorney General forward, to the report itself that fails to find illegal action, which of course Ken Starr did. Ken Starr was chomping at the bit and drooling to find his way to illegal action. And Robert Mueller's report is actually too shy and too coy to actually come right out and say this obstructive evidence is obstruction of justice. And I think that failure to reach those legal conclusions is sacrificing law in a world of divided politics, and it's a very poor precedent.
Here's a question from Julia. Why isn't handing over polling data considered collusion? And going back to you, Sarah, and even going back to the Mueller report, there's more information about what Manafort was willing to share with some of his Russian or Ukrainian-based counterparts.
You know, I don't think we fully know the answers to why that wasn't a bigger issue. We didn't find out about that polling data sharing until well after the first trial of Paul Manafort, until well after he pleaded guilty in the second case, and well into whether after the fact where he was accused of lying to prosecutors during his cooperation sessions. I don't think they had the goods to be able to use that as a charge. And so I don't have a window into their thinking, and right. It's not exact. They're not the chattiest bunch, obviously. But I mean, if they were going to charge that, they would have done that on day one, or at least in one of the other superseding indictments that came out. There's several of them after Manafort was charged. I think that this is a group of very seasoned people, really respected attorneys, and if they were able to make a case on that polling data being shared with Manafort's business associate, Konstantin Kalimnik, who is the U.S. intelligence believe is connected to Russian intelligence, they would have done so from the outset.
Interesting. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, the reason, I think, the simple legal reason is because giving that polling data was not in exchange for hacked data, and it wasn't in exchange for Russian interference. So it may very well have been helpful to the Russians or whatever else in their debates about politically how often that happens. But the conspiracy they're looking for is a conspiracy to influence the election through the Russians, and a conspiracy to hack the DNC, and that just wasn't it.
Yeah.
You know, that is evidence about connections between Trump and Russia. It's circumstantial evidence, but it is not a smoking gun, I think, on the kind of conspiracy they're looking for.
Well, and it seems like as if Manafort had his own side deal that he was
Correct.
Dealing with that was separate from the campaign,
Correct.
Even though they probably intersected at some point. Excuse me. Mueller did not directly interview the president, Donald Trump. He was given a list of questions and provided answers. According to the Mueller team, the answers were inadequate. But it seemed that Mueller was saying, if we fight this, it might take us another year or two to get this report out, and made the decision to sort of move ahead. What do you make of that, Craig?
Yeah, I think this is in this broader spirit of the Mueller report. I think he viewed himself as doing what was in the public good and the public interest. Again, not unlike what Jim Comey thought in an opposite direction 2 years before. And I think those sorts of compromises have costs. It's true that if he tried, or he could have subpoenaed Don Jr. He didn't even subpoena Don Jr. But if he had tried to force an interview with the president, he might have won or lost. If he had tried to find obstruction of justice by the president, it might have been suppressed. The report might have been suppressed in a way that it wasn't by Bill Barr, much to his credit, I might add. I think Sarah already mentioned that. So I think he made choices about sort of what he thought was the best thing to do, and he thought fighting over an interview, anyone can read. He attaches an appendix, the answers to those questions, which are basically, I don't remember anything. So, of course, anyone can draw their own political conclusions about what they think the president's telling the truth after reading. If anyone makes it through volume two and you make it to the appendix, you're not going to think the president is telling the truth about not remembering anything, which is another way of saying that the basic baseline fact is we have an obstructive, untruthful president, as some number of people have known for a long time, and as some number of people will learn for the first time in a newly credible way through the Mueller report.
We're almost out of time here, Sarah, but it's interesting. Yesterday, the president seemed rather pleased with the report and was tweeting out lots of tweets that seemed to exonerate him. But it seems that he's changed his tune a bit today. He doesn't seem so happy about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's been going back and forth like this for quite some time. And I think the new narrative now is going to be, which we've already seen coming, investigate the investigators. And there's going to, and I think Bill Barr is actually going to factor into that narrative. He's already said, you know, that he wants to review the origins of this case, whether there were improper behavior by the FBI when it obtained surveillance warrants. And so I think we're going to see that is going to be the new wave of what Trump is pushing for, and it's going to be, you know, continuing to beat up the Justice Department, albeit not Bill Barr himself, but the FBI more broadly, and it's going to become the new narrative.
Craig, 10 seconds. Go ahead.
It's a terrible distraction, and of course that's been the strategy for a long time, and I hope the American people, of course America depends on the American people to see through that and try to figure out the truth of the matter. And the fact of the matter is this investigation began because Trump, a relationship of the Trump campaign to Russia, a perfectly legitimate investigation as documented by the Mueller report. There were tons of efforts to obstruct it, and this investigation was an effort to investigate the investigators, and we have the results.
And it began Papadopoulos at a bar in England mouthing off. What
so
can
true.
We say? Craig Green, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Sarah Lynch, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's a criminal justice reporter covering the Department of Justice for Reuters. We appreciate all those questions and comments. Sorry we could not get to all of them. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.